he basically fell in love with her. He was in his 70s, she was in her mid-50s. She would stay with him, dip his wallet, took his card, drew money, all sorts, but he just wouldn't do anything against her. They ended up getting married. He approached us and said, look, I realise I should have taken action a long time ago. The guy sadly passed away short time afterwards, and the old boy changed his will and she didn't inherit from him. But she'd got his dead wife's jewellery, cars.
Yeah, damage had been
done. Yeah. Because it's very difficult to change the mindset. Someone's in love with someone, then...
Yeah. So welcome to this week's Cognitas Global Podcast. This week I'm joined by a friend of mine, a former policeman who, like me, has been retired for some time. And we're going to talk about an interesting topic today, which is fraud against the elderly. But if I can just introduce him all the way from over there, Mr. Paul Smith. Welcome, Paul.
Welcome. Thank you very much.
Paul, let's just start with this. I've alluded to the fact that, like me, you were in the police for 30 years. You retired as a financial investigator, detective. Do you just want to tell us what you've been up to since you retired?
Well, just before I retired, I qualified as a forensic accountant, and I used those skills in a number of sort of topics, ranging from sort of insolvency work. Elder fraud is my specialism, which is obviously the topic we're going to talk about today. But I get involved in many things. I've been a prosecution expert for the CPS and a defence expert on a couple of occasions. I do a lot of sort of civil litigation, get involved with matrimonial stuff, and anything that perhaps needs some sort of detailed analysis, I can get involved in it, and I'm more than happy to do so.
You're being very modest as well, because I can reveal, of course, that you went and worked for me in the Cayman Islands. I would say it's a holiday. You would say that you were working hard for me.
Well, it might have been a holiday if we hadn't had COVID, of course. And we were there during the lockdown, as you know. You know, we had these beautiful views and lovely beaches, as you know yourself, and we couldn't use any of it, which was, you know, we kind of got used to it. We were there. Everything was locked down. It's the same for everybody. But yes.
I'm struggling for my violin somewhere. It is here somewhere.
But yeah, it was okay.
However, look, let's get on to the serious topic today. Okay, so we've talked about the fact we're going to deal with elderly fraud today, which is quite a serious topic. And normally these podcasts are quite light. But I know there's a lot of people approach me and ask me for my advice. It's a very specialist topic, and I don't pretend to be an expert, about issues they've had perhaps with family members or strangers or other circumstances. They've not had any support or cooperation from the police. And I want to try and have people walk away from this podcast being better informed, perhaps with a potential solution for them. It's an awful topic, perhaps more prevalent. I mean, how have you seen this on the increase perhaps over the years, Paul? Let's start with that.
Well, sadly, statistically, elder abuse, not just the fraud, elder abuse is more prevalent than child abuse and domestic abuse combined. And that's internationally. But unfortunately, a lot of it is kind of hidden. Goes on behind closed doors. The data is scarce, but you know, estimates suggest that it's a big problem, only getting worse. Some countries deal with it better than others. In the UK, I feel we're going backwards. The Americans seem to have got a handle on it. They've got the right legislation in place. We kind of struggle here. I get extremely frustrated with the response from my former colleagues within the police, in that they tend to write a lot of this stuff off as a civil matter, and it certainly isn't. And in my view, they're not qualified to make that assertion.
Yeah, I must say, we're always going to say this, we come from a different generation, but some of the stories that I've heard about, you know, people that have approached the police and the response they've got is quite shocking, really. But let's talk about maybe some of the typologies that might be familiar to people. So I know there's something called early inheritance syndrome. We'll deal with some stuff perhaps around siblings or other members of the family, and then some stranger type stuff. But maybe you could just tell us a little bit more about this early inheritance syndrome, as it's known.
It's something I found a bit of research done by someone in Australia. She coined the term early inheritance syndrome. And I thought, God, that fits so well. So it's basically where a family kind of see their inheritance dwindling away in front of their eyes in sort of care fees, and they do everything they can to try and move the money sideways to get it out from the grasp of the local authority. They fall foul generally when the funds dip to the level which requires support from the local authority. So basically, they kind of draw the money, put it aside, shift it into offshore or wherever they put it, and then they then go cap in hand to the local authority. The local authority will say, okay, we need to go back to look at the finances, and that's when they have a big problem, because then they've got to explain what's happened to the money. And they see this as what's called a self-deprivation of assets. So if they uncover transfers of money just prior to them making the approach to local authority, they'll say, you need to get that money back into the account, because this is a self-deprivation of assets, and therefore we will not support funding for domiciliary care.
So normally it's instigated by who, this sort of activity?
So generally it's one sibling is kind of a bit more errant than others, and they will kind of get wind of what's going on, and then they'll make the referral to the local authority. It could be a lawyer who then takes on, you know, the role of a power of attorney. It comes through different sources. Certainly, you know, to me as a former police officer, when I used to receive them, it would generally come from the local authority. And to be honest, those cases that I dealt with in the police, it was at that point when people had got rid of the money because they thought, okay, I'm now good. I could go to the local authority and they'll pay for mum's care. And then they realised that they made an awful big mistake.
So that requires, obviously, you know, somebody within the family to be taking that deliberate action to try and effectively, you know, hide the funds from the authority. If that's being done by a member of the family outside of the knowledge of another member of the family, how is that going to perhaps be best identified? What do people need to look for to see whether that's the type of thing that's going on?
Well, strangely enough, I had a phone call only the tail end of last week, and this lady had concerns about her older brother. And so she and her younger brother had kind of got together, and mum was at the point where she kind of lost capacity, mental capacity. So they'd approached a local solicitor to take on the role as deputy. They've seen evidence that the elder brother has kind of had his hand in the cookie jar, so to speak. So I said, look, once the deputy's, you know, in position and they've got then legal access to the finances, if you need me, I can assist the family. So what I tend to do with my reports is, you know, I'll have a timeline for sort of the decline in the mental health, and then overlay that with what's happened with the finances. So, you know, you've got this dual timeline, which is very persuasive to a court if needs be. Generally, we get to a position where a report from me or another sort of expert is sufficient to persuade the other party to kind of right the wrong that they've done. So it's not always a case of going to the police or to take, you know, civil litigation. It's using the evidence as a lever to make them do the right thing.
So if a member of the family that's not party to that deliberate act to conceal those assets from the authority finds this activity, what should they do? Should they go to the police, or should they be trying to find somebody like yourself, a forensic accountant, to support them in this, and then the relative referral be made to either the police or the authority?
Yeah, well, I'm more than happy to sort of field any calls from anybody for advice, which I've done a couple of times in the last couple of weeks. It's key to, if you're going to approach the police, it's key to get your evidence together, to have at least a prima facie case and know where the evidence can be found. Because quite often, if you just say, I have suspicion, the police will say, well, come back when you've got the evidence.
Yeah.
Simple as that. The other one, of course, is to make a safeguarding inquiry to the local authority. Again, when I was in the police, I would say to people, you know, if you're making this referral to us, you need to make it to the local authority. So belt and braces, police and local authority. One key thing I tend to say to my clients is you need to take the emotion out. You know, I had a lady, she was distraught, yeah, totally distraught. I said, look, you know, the best will in the world, you can't concentrate and doing the right thing when you've got emotion involved. And when we kind of put the case together between us, she gave me the material and I did a report. She said, you know, that was the best thing you ever said to me. Take the emotion out, because I was able to sort of clear my head a little bit and understand what's going on. And I could sort of, you know, see a way forward. Emotion is...
It's going to be hard though, isn't it?
It is.
In a lot of cases where, you know, you've got this inter-family conflict and interest, particularly around, you know, potential crime, criminal activity, is going to be very difficult. Well, I mean, we'll talk more about what they might need to do and what the evidence that they might need to do to get together. Let's maybe talk about something slightly different, maybe still within the family, something like sibling or other member of the family, the type of fraud that you're coming across there in relation to towards the elderly person.
Perhaps it's good to cite cases. So I've helped a family in London. I took a number of witness statements. And basically, we're dealing with a fraudulent will. And what he'd got here is four or five siblings, elderly parents. Mum was sadly quite ill with cancer. Mum passed away and a will was produced by one of the siblings. Well, it turns out the partner of this particular siblings had spent 12 years in the scrubs for fraud. So we kind of knew what the driver was behind this.
Wormwood Scrubs being
the prison. Yes, sorry. Kind of making assumptions there. So basically what had happened, mum passed away. This will was supposed to have been written on Boxing Day when all the family were gathered. It was total garbage. But unfortunately, the family have had to do everything they could to try and get things sort of turned around. One of the issues they had to deal with initially was the fact that a big fancy Irish funeral was to take place, mum's home being Ireland, with a burial. Now, all the family, the close family knew that a burial was not what mum wanted because she was frightened of creepy crawlies and, you know, that was the last thing she would have wanted to happen. And she didn't want this elaborate funeral in Ireland because she had no family left in Ireland. So it transpired that the funeral director was a close friend of the sibling, the errant sibling, and was obviously getting a kickback for kind of, you know, his part in this. So we ended up taking lots of statements and the evidence was presented. It's still trundling along, but I've done a mini kind of report. But once the solicitor has a handle on the finances, I'm guessing there's going to be significant money laundering, fraud and all sorts that's taking place. But it's having to go in stages. And sadly, the family have kind of, they've had to fund the litigation. They've got maxed out on the credit cards to fund this. I spoke to Dad. I did a video interview with Dad in London. And he said to me, I really don't know why she's doing this. His daughter, she had everything she ever wanted in life. And I just feel like killing myself. I thought, no, whoa, you know, we had to sort of pull him back. But I felt desperately sorry for him and the family. It was just so sad.
There's some incredibly sad stories coming out of this, because even if an individual, a son or daughter, is not interested in the inheritance, it's the activity of the others within the family that can split that family and cause such distress and harm. You know, there's no good news stories very often in this.
No,
at all,
and I gave a presentation at an end of life doulas conference in London. Doulas are support people when they're terminally ill, and my presentation was the most darkest one of the day. And there was people talking about budget funerals and flat pack coffins and stuff like that, and they were all very bubbly. And then my subject came up, and I thought, God, this is depressing compared to this. And then we're talking about death all day. So it is, it's a dark subject.
It is, yeah. And the other thing is, you know, the most important thing is it's hard enough to deal with without then getting a rebuff from the police when you are insistent that you've probably, you know, found some fraud. And to be fair to the police, look, a lot of the time they're caught between this very difficult situation over the competency of the actual victim, of course, aren't they? But there are provisions for that. And how does that got round? You know, the police will say, well, you know, they're giving away all this money, you know, they're doing it, we can't prove otherwise, and maybe they're not fit for court to give evidence and all the rest of it. How do we manage that, or how do they manage that side of it?
Well, you know, I get extremely frustrated with response from our former colleagues. That said, I know things are changing. For instance, in West Yorkshire, there's a joint task force which has been set up by Trading Standards. So there's police, local authority, Trading Standards, and they are getting some really good work done and results where actually they're improving the quality of the service being provided because they're able to learn from the jobs as they go along. And it's made a remarkable difference to the people in West Yorkshire. I'm hoping something like that is going to roll out elsewhere in the UK. But I was so pleased to hear about this particular service.
Well, look, let's try and get some good news here before I start having to call the Samaritans as well, because this is just it is a dark topic.
It's important
we bring this to people. You know, I know there's some good news out of this. You were telling me previously about a change in law in the Isle of Man, I think, some pressure that's been applied and that they've changed the law.
I was really pleased to be involved in this. So there's a lady who's works for a firm of accountants in the Isle of Man. She has run into problems herself, having had issues with her siblings, with her parents. So she set off on this campaign to get the law changed in the Isle of Man. And so what we've done, I managed to introduce her to an American, he's actually a British guy who lives in the States. And this guy, Paul Greenwood, is a recently retired deputy district attorney. And he set up the first elder abuse prosecutions unit in San Diego. So Paul, knowing how things work in the UK, knows how the English law is, but knows how successful the American law is. I got the two together, Bridget and Paul together, and Paul suggested to Bridget that you might want to try and persuade the legislators on the Isle of Man to bring in the type of legislation we've got in the UK. It's a hybrid of criminal and civil law. So if the criminal law fails, then the civil law kicks in and allows a recovery through, you know, the civil courts. So in the States, what that's done is introduced like a cadre of specialist lawyers who will sometimes work pro bono or on a contingency fee basis to try and recover monies, lost monies through various frauds against the elderly. So that has been sort of basically bundled up and put into legislation on the Isle of Man. It's gone through the courts over there, and they're now rolling out training for prosecutors and law enforcement to use the new law. It's absolutely fantastic. So I'm really hoping that once we see the success of the Isle of Man, that I can, with the help of press and media, to persuade the UK legislators to do something similar, because it's just a win-win, you know.
Well, when you talk about statistics, as you did earlier on, it's almost that we need it.
Well, definitely.
You know, although, you know, the difficulty is, of course, it's not necessarily a priority for national policing, notwithstanding the amount of money that's actually stolen and people are defrauded by. So let's talk about the stranger, the befriending one. A friend of mine spoke to me last year about some difficulty they had in their family with their very elderly father, who had succumbed to a much younger lady, of course, who he perceived to have fallen in love with, and then the money stripping started. So he is willingly giving that individual money. The police, of course, weren't interested, you know, putting forward the typical argument about he's in the right state of mind when clearly, you know, he's not, but he is of a state of mind to be doing that, you know, without any physical pressure, but clearly the mental pressure was there. How do we deal with stuff like this? I mean, give us some examples of this stranger befriending. What can people do? What do they need to look for? What evidence do they need to collect?
That's the kind of the most difficult scenario to deal with, really.
Yeah.
You know, where financial data is available, previous wills, it's a matter of sort of gathering together your evidence before kind of making an approach to any authority. Just a very quick case that I dealt with as a cop, but it's relevant to what's gone on here. So basically, this lady worked as a cleaner stroke carer for this elderly lady and was kiting checks. So she's basically ripping checks out the back of the checkbook, writing checks out to herself and forging a signature. She was convicted, and although she had a teenage son, the probation service thought it was best that she didn't get a custodial sentence, which the defending should have attracted. They suggested that she needed some sort of community service order. So, okay, she was weighed off and she got a community sentence. And where did they place her? In a day centre for the elderly. So on the very first day, she recruits her next victim, who is a retired estate agent. And I can't remember how we got wind, but we got wind of what was going on. I dispatched one of my colleagues to sort of visit Del Chap and say, she'd been a bit careful about what she disclosed, but she kind of went along with a local press report of the conviction with a view of trying to persuade the old boy. And sadly, he would have none of it. He basically fell in love with her. He was in his 70s. She was in her mid-50s, I guess, at that time. We worked with him. She would stay with him or stay late in the evening, dip his wallet before she went home, took his card, drew money from the ATM. All sorts sort of went on, but he just wouldn't do anything against her. Now, the twist in the tale, they ended up getting married. He approached us and said, look, I realized that I should have, you know, I should have taken action a long time ago, but didn't. So we said, look, it's probably a little bit late now, but, you know, we can see what we can do. So we had the woman in, sort of read her the riot act, so to speak. Anyway, the guy sadly passed away a short time afterwards, and we found out they'd actually changed his will. So he, although she'd had significant money, the old boy changed his will and she didn't inherit from him. But she'd got his dead wife's jewellery, cars.
Yeah, damage had been done.
But so those, because it's very difficult to sort of change the mindset, you know, someone's in love with someone, then...
Yeah,
it's very difficult.
And the inheritance of the kids are fast disappearing in those circumstances.
Yeah, so in that particular case, he didn't have any beneficiaries, but left all his estate to a big charity. So, you know, I was pleased that happened.
And is there nothing really that can be done in that situation where that person falls in love?
It's all about mental capacity. So, you know, the Mental Capacity Act is. It's a useful bit of legislation, but it's kind of proving that they didn't have the decision-making capacity at the time. And, you know, sadly, I tend to get involved more after the event, after the people have passed away, and when it becomes a contentious probate matter. So all I can say is just gather as much material as you can to try and define a timeline of, you know, a breakdown in mental capacity and where coercion sort of creeps in. Because in civil law, if you introduce sort of coercive...
Influence.
It flips on its head and it's then down to the other party to prove that they had an implied undue influence. So that's kind of... The most difficult ones that I've dealt with are those where someone's kind of fallen in love and... Clearly, from the outset, it's pretty obvious what's been going on, but it's so difficult to persuade the party.
So, if we were to leave some people with takeaways today, Paul, because it's a massive subject. There's no easy solution or no easy answer. I mean, from my point of view and my experience, you know, just as an ex-cop, it would be, you know, gather those bank statements, gather whatever information you can get that shows that behavior that the police might use or might be of use to somebody like yourself, a forensic accountant, an expert that's going to help. Any other points from your point of view and your experience?
Trying to persuade the party to see a lawyer is often a good one because they can speak confidentially. In fact, I just remember that's where that came in with the estate agent. He'd been persuaded by a close friend to speak to a lawyer, and it was the lawyer that actually phoned the police. Any sort of trusted sort of third party, really. If, you know, if someone's got the ear of the victim and can sort of try and persuade them, then that's kind of all you can do, really. And it's just gather as much material as you can. Yeah, it's not an easy one. Power of attorney. So yes, powers of attorney. That's an interesting one. It can work both ways. One of the worst cases I've kind of dealt with in the police was a breach of a power of attorney. And it only came to be because this woman had a power of attorney, had this piece of paper that gave her authority. Nowadays, when someone takes out a power of attorney, and I would always recommend a power of attorney, I would advise to have a professional attorney as well as a family member. Sort of belt and braces, just to monitor. You know, if you're doing a good job and there's a jealous sibling who starts to point the finger at you, at least you've then got the sort of back cover from the solicitor. There is a facility now where you can get a power of attorney bond. So if you take deputyship, so if a person has lost mental capacity, the only route that they can then take is through deputyship through the court of protection. So, and a person taking on the role of a deputy would be required to have a bond in place, an insurance bond. So there is now a new process where you can take out a power of attorney bond. So it protects anybody for sort of any mismanagement of finances or mistakes. You know, you could have a situation whereby someone is perhaps receiving an income through Department of Work and Pensions, through, you know, income support or whatever, and they've made a mistake with, you know, getting them the right benefits that they're entitled to. This bond would then cover them and would pay out in the event that they've made a genuine mistake or there's been mismanagement of the money. So that's always good.
And you go to a lawyer.
Yeah.
You go to a lawyer to get that bond.
Yeah.
I know this is really a passionate thing for you. I know you give people some help and advice where you can, and obviously people engage you professionally. Do you want to give a shout out for your own consultancy here? We'll put the stuff on the screen for everybody.
It's simply Paul Smith Consultancy, paulsmithconsultancy.com. I'm more than happy to field any questions people have, provide advice, but more importantly, I'm more than happy to provide sort of reports that are required for any litigation or support people that, you know, feel that need to gather the information to go to the police or authority of the court. A couple of years back, a chap was making an application to the Office of the Public Guardian. He had concerns about his sister, so he wanted some help to sort of put together the evidence. It was a form that, you know, one of the OPG forms. So basically he employed me to kind of put it, you know, in a right format for the court, and more than happy to do. I tend to get involved with lawyers. I've just recently done a case last week whereby I've got the software to be able to convert bank statements into an Excel spreadsheet, which even if people just want that so they can analyze the data themselves, or I'm more than happy to do that for them, then I've got, you know, the ability to do that for people.
Sure. And just to clarify that, I know the software that you're talking about there, because we used to use it for our investigations, and it will absolutely convert and analyze statements and bring out stuff that ordinarily you just couldn't get from a bank statement. But look, they can get all that support when they call you. Paul, I want to thank you very much for being on this today. It's a dark subject. Yeah. It's not, well, normally it's a little bit lighter. I'm not quite at the point where I want to ring the Samaritans. But what I will say is, I think as a result of this, I have identified that I've been the victim of elder abuse for about the last 36 years. I'll give you the name of the suspect. I guess you can probably guess Mrs. Day. So I'll be giving you a ring up after this podcast. But
okay, mate, no problem.
Thanks, mate. I really appreciate your time. And I admire your passion. Keep up the excellent work in the field that you do. Okay. And I hope this has been useful for many people that this resonates with.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.